This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington.
Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Peter Jennings at ABC News World Headquarters. We want to bring you up to date at the shooting at Columbine High School.
We left the library. We just kind of ran and were running towards the cop cars.
They just came in and they started shooting, and I heard everybody saying, get down, get down.
Perhaps now America would wake up to the dimensions of this challenge.
It's actually become a part of our language, a Columbine-style attack.
Columbine really gave birth to the modern fear of kids being shot in schools.
We're still struggling to figure out why did that happen.
Twenty years ago, two teenagers murdered a dozen students and one teacher at Columbine High School in Colorado. Since then, more than 220,000 students have been exposed to gun violence in schools, and the threat of a school shooting is always there. An 18-year-old woman is dead of a self-inflicted gunshot wound after threatening violence against Denver schools. Investigators say Sol Pais was infatuated with the Columbine shooting, so much so that she flew from Miami to Denver, bought a shotgun, and hid in the Colorado foothills for nearly 2 days. More than 1,000 Denver-area schools closed yesterday as police searched for her. She was found dead on Mount Evans yesterday afternoon. Joining us from KUNC Public Radio in Greeley, about an hour from Denver, is reporter Lee Patterson. She's part of Guns and America, a reporting collaborative that focuses on America's relationship with firearms. Lee, welcome to the program.
Hi there.
We'll talk about the broader question of what's changed in America since Columbine, but tell us more about what happened this week. What more do we know about Sol Pais?
Sure. So she was an 18-year-old high school student in Miami. As you mentioned earlier this week, law enforcement found her dead by suicide in an apparent gunshot wound. The whole thing started a couple of days ago. Pais came to Denver. She landed at Denver International Airport Monday morning. She went and bought a shotgun. The FBI division here in Denver at some point was made aware of her presence and basically frantically began searching for her because, you know, in their estimation, she had made threats that were credible in the area. She was infatuated with the Columbine High School shooting. Now, the FBI has said the threats were not specific to any particular school. They have also really haven't given out any details on these threats, but it all led to a massive manhunt and hundreds, perhaps, you know, over 1,000 Front Range schools were closed. And ultimately, it all ended in the discovery of her body.
This must have been especially emotional for Coloradans, especially because Colorado passed a new red flag law just last Friday.
Yes, yes, absolutely. I think this has been a very emotional thing for Coloradans. On one hand, some people have said, really, an 18-year-old kid can shut down hundreds of schools and, you know, scare an entire metro area, really? And then on the other hand, people were terrified, you know, not letting their kids be on the cul-de-sac, imagining this woman creeping around in their neighborhood and, you know, really just feeling terrified and shaken in the wake of the, you know, the 20th anniversary of the Columbine High School shooting this weekend. It's been very difficult for communities, and a few of the Columbine survivors that I've been talking with and texting to were quite shaken up by this whole thing.
And worth noting, of course, red flag laws are designed to prevent people who seem to be a threat to public safety from acquiring firearms. Let's shift gears to Columbine itself. When it comes to that, what exactly have you been focusing on?
So a couple of months ago, I was listening to a hearing going on at the Colorado State House about a bill that would allow people to carry guns on school grounds. And these types of discussions are going on around the country. One of the first people to testify in favor of the bill was a guy named Evan Todd.
As the two murderers made their way into the school and into the library, I was the first one targeted as they fired.
He was shot. Shrapnel blew back into his face.
And they walked around murdering my classmates execution style with no one to stop them. It's been 20 years and a lot of things were different and a lot of things have changed. But one thing that has not changed is I do not believe we have seriously taken into consideration how we protect and defend our children in our schools.
A few weeks later, I drove out to meet Evan at his home near Denver. He asked me not to say where exactly he lives because he says that weird people sometimes contact him about Columbine. Internet threats, stuff like that.
Nice to meet you.
I meet Evan's two little chihuahuas and his son Hunter.
Hello. How old are you?
Just over a year.
Evan's home with him on Fridays. They eat snacks, play with trucks. Eventually, Evan puts the baby down for a nap so we can sit and talk.
20 years later, are your memories of the shooting at your school still sharp? Or are you starting to forget details?
I can still remember the feelings and the sounds and the smells. And
that day, 20 years ago, he was in the library with his friends, attempting to write a paper.
So yeah, we were in there, you know, joking around and throwing little wads of paper at each other, and you know,
you were being a teenager.
Yeah, we were 15 years old. So, and then just in an instant, it's hard to explain because you had this adrenaline, but then you had this helplessness.
There was an explosion, smoke, then pops of gunfire echoing through the hallways. A teacher came in and screamed for everybody to get down.
I remember thinking, okay, the police have got to be coming. Someone with a gun has got to come in here, stop these guys, we're going to get out of here. And nothing. And one of them kneeled down and put a gun to my head and said, why shouldn't we kill you?
The killers didn't pull the trigger. Evan got out of the library alive. And that day, naturally, has really informed his thinking about safety and guns. After the incident, the first time he shot one, Evan said that the sound made his heart race. It brought back memories. He wondered if maybe access to guns was the problem. Evan decided, no, it was people, not guns, that were the problem, and that generally, when used responsibly, guns make people safer. Like teachers carrying guns in schools. Evan explains what he means by that.
We should not ever ask a teacher to carry a firearm. We should just not disarm the ones that want to. And likewise, I don't think we should have the gun-free zones. There's no reason a parent who, like myself, has my carry concealed weapons permit, should be disarmed at the door when I go to pick up my child from class.
Currently, teachers or school staff in districts in 31 states can legally carry weapons in schools, according to a review of state laws and local news coverage by Guns in America. There aren't any federal standards. The Education Commission of the States, an organization that tracks education policy, says that it's not aware of any state that allows districts to require that their teachers carry a weapon. Evan believes a teacher with a gun can make a difference during a school shooting.
What actually stops these from happening? And in the world we live in, a firearm is one of those ways. A firearm would have saved lives at Columbine.
Evan Todd's story is just one story, one perspective, formed around a rare worst-case scenario. Carrie LaFollette is a Columbine survivor who's now a teacher in Wyoming. At a school board meeting last year, a local news outlet reported she said that if teachers had guns that day, quote, I cannot imagine how much worse that situation would have turned out. Evan and Carrie's perspectives matter because these experiences are what many parents all over the country are afraid of. And those fears are driving the decisions around arming teachers. This is Ken Trump.
No relation to the president.
He's worked in school safety for over 30 years, and he thinks allowing teachers to carry guns is a bad idea.
I personally support concealed carry and respect Second Amendment rights, but the issue here is not one of protecting yourself. You're talking about tasking teachers, support staff members, to perform a public safety function.
Trump puts this discussion in the context of police officers using firearms.
What is interesting to me is that we've spent, as a nation, the past 5 or 10 years increasingly being critical of law enforcement, and we've demanded more training, more scrutiny. And at the same time now, we were having a conversation where we say give somebody much less training compared to a police officer, put them in a school, and everything's going to be better.
There isn't much data out there to suggest whether or not arming teachers would make things better. But the FBI has looked at active shooter situations, analyzing 160 of these incidents between 2000 and 2013. Most of them ended before police arrived, many in 5 minutes or less. The majority of incidents ended in the shooter killing themselves or fleeing or just stopping shooting. Just 5 of these active shooter situations were stopped by an armed civilian or security guard. And there are risks to those armed individuals. There's a chance they could be killed by the shooter or by law enforcement. As for the everyday risks, guns could be left in a bathroom or stolen out of a car, discharged accidentally, or simply used in a dangerous way. I asked Evan Todd, the Columbine survivor, about these risks, that a teacher could be mistaken for an active shooter, for example.
You're absolutely right that it does happen, but it's so minuscule. It's so small.
For Evan, the potential benefits simply outweigh the potential risks. Recently, he's become more focused, more passionate on the issue of safety, and his son has been a big part of it.
You know, because I'm thinking about his upbringing and his future, and now it's a whole new motivation for the future, if that makes sense.
No matter how you define a mass shooting, they account for less than 2% of gun deaths in the U.S. each year. Evan gets that.
Had I not gone through it, I don't know if I would have the same perspective. And that's the difficult part, you know, because I can see that side of it where people carry on because they know how rare and how safe their children are. But, you know, I've seen evil in this world. Ignoring it never does anything.
We'll continue our special look back at the legacy of Columbine with KUNC's Lee Patterson in just a moment. I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to a special edition of 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We're talking to KUNC's Lee Patterson on the 20-year anniversary of Columbine. Lee is a reporting fellow with Guns and America. It's a project that looks at the role of guns in American life. Lee, it's pretty clear that there have been some real policy changes since then, but what does it mean that our policymaking is so reactive rather than proactive?
Yeah, so I talked to David Ropeek about that.
I am a retired Harvard instructor and an author of books about risk perception and how worrying too much or too little can get us into trouble.
Ropeek says that given the relative rarity of school shootings, we might be overreacting when we let them drive policy, but there's a good reason for it.
We are exquisitely afraid of any risks to our kids, which makes evolutionary sense because to keep the species going, our kids are tomorrow's version of the species. When a risk is being talked about a lot in the media, amongst friends, amongst parents sending their kids off to school, as Columbine has made school shootings in general, and then another one happens and then another one happens, it becomes a bigger blip on that risk radar screen. And that alone disproportionately magnifies how scary that risk seems.
I see what he's getting at, Lee, but that doesn't mean we should disregard these incidents, right?
No, not at all. Ropeek explains that it's really more of a question of awareness.
We can't not feel the terrible hurt and horror at school shootings, but we can also realize that our fear and our horror can be getting in the way of what's best for our kids. That's why having this conversation matters.
By that, he means 2 things. Number 1, that it's important not to unnecessarily frighten students about school shootings. And number 2, not to let those adult fears distract from other solutions or other bigger problems. School districts across the country are dealing with this as they make decisions on school safety. They can buy things like security cameras, sure, but they can also take preventative measures like providing mental health services. I decided to go to Columbine High School to talk about school safety through mental health. I set up a meeting with one of the guidance counselors there. Her name is Noelle Sedano.
How's it going?
Good.
So as soon as I get out of my car, this guy walks up to me.
Yeah. Did I park in an okay place?
You parked great. Okay. We just like to contact people that we don't always recognize at the school.
Yeah. Man, you spotted me quickly.
I'm pretty good at my job.
So I checked in and then made my way to the counseling office.
Are you Lee?
Yes.
Hi, I'm Noelle. Nice I just you. Need like 2 minutes to talk to this student real quick. Do you mind just having a seat?
A couple minutes later, Noelle tells me about her job. There's the usual stuff, like helping kids with college applications, scheduling, resolving conflicts between teachers and students, but one of the biggest issues she deals with
anxiety is huge. And there are a lot of kids that are dealing with higher levels of anxiety than I ever remembered coming up in high school.
A recent study by the Pew Research Center confirms this. High levels of depression and anxiety reported by teens. Noelle also deals with issues related to suicide, which is a growing problem in Colorado. These are common issues today, but Columbine is a school with an uncommon past. As we talk about it, Noelle shows me around.
So this
smells like a cafeteria.
And the weight room is over there.
Which is to say, Columbine looks and smells like any other high school. Blue lockers, long fluorescent overhead lights, kids carrying trombones and gym bags. There are memories, and some parts of the school have changed.
So down here, there's a new library.
There's a plaque with 13 names on it.
This library is dedicated to the victims.
And do you feel that there could be any connection between there having been a shooting here 20 years ago and worries about shootings now?
I really don't hear a lot of that connection.
Some kids do worry, she says, but it's not something she's dealing with all the time. And 20 years ago, it wasn't a big worry either.
So for me personally, I don't really bring it up unless I am having a really heavy conversation with a kid that's talking about grief and loss.
Lee, at this point, listeners should know that Noelle was a student at Columbine when the shooting happened. She's one of a handful of students from 20 years ago who now work at the school.
So I was a sophomore, and when everything started happening, I was in my math class.
And the usual hallway noise?
It turned from, like, flirting screams to, like, terrified screams. And my teacher, she tried to kind of keep lecturing through it, and then she stopped, and I could see her face just went white.
Noelle made her way out.
And it was just hundreds of kids just pouring out of the building, running down that hallway and out the side door. So I went with a group of probably about 30, maybe 40 kids. We ran to another student's house, and kids were like scattered throughout the neighborhood. They were knocking on strangers' doors and asking to hide in their homes.
Eventually, they got word to go to an elementary school.
So that's where we got connected to our parents. You couldn't leave unless a parent came to pick you up. I'd never seen my dad look so shaken. He hugged me so tight, I had to tell him to let go because I couldn't breathe. I remember on that day hearing someone say, like, as everything was unfolding, I remember someone said to me, there are kids in our school with guns. And I refused to believe it until I saw something on the news. It just seemed so completely impossible. That's a representation of the general thinking at that time.
Given what you went through, why did you decide to come back to Columbine High School as a professional?
Right. It's weird, right? I think that, again, it just felt like a calling to me. And I think, too, that it helps me to reclaim some of the emotions that I have towards Columbine. Because now I can say that this is a place of community and love and health and joy. And when I finished high school, it didn't necessarily feel that way.
Mental health care in schools has changed since Columbine. A task force put together by Colorado's governor back then recommended all sorts of things. Anonymous tip lines, bullying prevention, threat assessment teams, and a lot of that has been put in place. States and districts around the country are making their own changes. Last year, Virginia and New York became the first two states to pass laws requiring mental health education in schools.
I do think that there's a lot more conversation about things to look for and red flags. Unfortunately, I think a lot of those things have been learned from what happened at Columbine.
So what sort of impact are these changes having? I talked to Sarah Goodrum about that.
I'm the department chair in criminology and criminal justice at the University of Northern Colorado.
Earlier in the day, she had testified at the state legislature about what the state has learned about school safety over the past 20 years.
I think for a while, there was the perception that schools are built to provide education, that they're not built to provide mental health or social support services. I think that philosophy has changed a lot since Columbine.
She explains why mental health services are an important part of violence prevention with a metaphor.
We talk about the metaphor of the iceberg in a lot of our work on school violence.
The kids who become school shooters, they're the tip of the iceberg, the worst case scenario.
We want to work on moving our efforts more toward prevention so that we can get at the underlying root causes of violence.
Instead, the types of incidents and struggles that are much more common than shootings, that's the rest of the iceberg.
Bullying, physical fights, suicidal ideation, self-harm. We know that there's pain.
Goodrum emphasizes that there is a lot more work to do on the issue, but what her iceberg metaphor also means is that some of the programs that were put in place after Columbine have gone way beyond stopping the next school shooter and have actually ended up impacting all sorts of kids.
Safe to Tell is a phone number, website, and app where you can anonymously report a concern or a threat. It started in Colorado back in 2004. It's since been adopted in Wyoming, and a few states have similar programs, including Pennsylvania, Maryland, and Nevada. Lee, you talked to one Safe to Tell worker in Colorado.
Lee Patterson.
Guy Grace is the director of security at Littleton Public Schools, and he's one of the people who actually fields these Safe to Tells. He gets the alerts throughout the school day, middle of the night, weekends, holidays.
Because it seems like a lot of times Safe to Tell is coming about 6 o'clock and I'll be at the gym and I'll be on the elliptical trainer at the weight room and I'll get the Safe to Tell. And what I'll do...
On your phone.
On my phone. And I look at it and then I start sending it out to the law enforcement and the mental health officials in our school district. There's always somebody on duty 24/7, 365. So we don't... Just because it's 8 o'clock at night and school's closed doesn't mean we're not going to be here for somebody.
During last year's school year, 16,000 tips came in statewide through Safe to Tell. The most common are suicide threats, followed by drugs and bullying. Guns, threats, school attacks, those are less common.
Some of those kids actually were in the process of overdosing or maybe cutting or doing something to themselves that was very dangerous.
If you're listening and thinking, well, that's great, but Safe to Tell also sounds like something kids could really mess with. They could use it to bully someone else. They do. According to the state, around 7% of Safe to Tells are bogus. And if you're thinking, well, the system probably doesn't always work, it doesn't. Guy Grace and the other first responders don't always get there in time. Once, he got a report of a picture on social media showing a kid with a gun in an elementary school. They didn't know if he was suicidal.
I was mowing my lawn, and I had a can of gasoline, and I'm speeding up to that school, and that gas can flips over in the back of my truck, and it's just leaking everywhere. But I remember going, we got to get there. I hope, you know.
He hoped they'd get there in time. They didn't. He says the boy died.
And sad thing is you see all that, but you did everything you could. But you get there, and you were hoping that you could have stopped it or... Those things weigh on you.
This is part of a special reporting collaboration with 1A and Guns and America. We're exploring what has changed and what has not in the 20 years since the Columbine shooting. Let's get back to Lee now.
Guy is an evangelist for Safe to Tell.
Why is this something you're willing to essentially devote your free time to?
Because it works.
He says he sleeps better, knowing he's doing what he can. Now, for all this talk about mental health, Littleton Public Schools has some serious physical security. Guy and I talked at the district's Security Operations Center. Over 100 video screens, security cameras, audio feeds, an automatic background check system to screen for sex offenders. Here's how Guy reconciles all of it.
When we look at physical security and putting that technology in there, it's kind of like the last resort. So when I look about mental health, it's wonderful to see now that we are trying to get on that to where we're trying to stop a school shooting or a suicide or bullying or whatever that hazard is related to mental health before it blows up into something bigger.
Guy Grace, the director of security at Littleton Public Schools, and Noelle Sedano, the guidance counselor at Columbine High School, have two very different jobs on paper, but they come to pretty similar conclusions on mental health care in schools.
I think this year in particular, in my own grief process of still processing what happened on April 20th, I think I'm feeling more of a calling to really be mindful of this mental health problem. I guess I'm like an eternal optimist. I want to think that if there's something we can do preventative, that we can always find this path of redemption or positivity or growth or I guess contributions that each of these kids can make to our community and our society.
Now, Liu spent a lot of time talking to Noelle and to Guy about the importance of counseling and helplines. How available are these resources in the first place?
Well, according to a new report from the American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU, schools are falling short in this department. The national student-to-counselor ratio, for example, is way above what's recommended by experts. School psychologists, many schools just don't have one. The ACLU report indicates that 43% of public school students go to schools without a psychologist, and the need is there. The ACLU report indicated that a majority of young people who need help don't get it, and those who do generally get it in school. So compare all of that to physical security. A market research firm called IHS crunched the numbers. And in 2017, the market for school security equipment and services reached $2.7 billion. So that imbalance is pretty significant.
Well, and on top of the difficulty in having those services, there's also just the existing stigma about mental illness or about getting treatment. How does the way that our country views mental illness factor into that?
Yeah, there absolutely is a stigma. And on top of that, according to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, only 3-5% of all violent acts could be attributed to someone with a serious mental illness. And people with a severe mental illness are actually 10 times more likely to be victims of a violent crime. So that misperception or lack of understanding is absolutely out there. We wanted to talk to actual students about all of this. Guns in America, our reporting project, we have reporters across the country, so we asked them to go into their communities and talk to students. This woman we're about to hear from is named Emily. She describes suffering from depression and anxiety.
Sometimes I feel like my anxiety isn't taken very seriously in some occasions. It's hard to understand because, like, there's such, like, a, oh, I'm nervous, I have anxiety. It's like, yeah, but it's much more than that. It's a deep fear of just so many, like, stupid and pointless things. It controls your life, but I feel like sometimes some adults don't take that seriously.
So we've heard about the approaches that schools are taking to address mental health, some of which, of course, is directly related to what happened at Columbine. How much do you feel like this shift in the way schools are approaching this has been meaningful?
Well, there's certainly been a shift in awareness and to some degree in approach. But as we've just been discussing, there aren't enough resources to go around. That's clear. You know, guidance counselors are stretched thin. And in some school districts, there are few to no services at all. And I would say that it's important to note that broadly, when we're talking about school safety, it's a really complex issue, whether, you know, it's physical security or mental health. There's not much data on what works. But there are a lot of people and organizations with very strong feelings and interests. I'm thinking about gun rights groups, gun control activists, concerned parents, the school security industry. And one expert actually told me that recently school administrators have been coming to him and telling him that it's really hard to figure out who to listen to on this subject.
Much more to discuss as we continue our conversation with KUNC's Lee Patterson as part of our special coverage of the 20th anniversary of the Columbine High School shooting. It's a collaboration with Guns and America. We'll get back to it in just a minute. Stay close. Back now to our conversation with KUNC's Lee Patterson about the legacy of the shooting at Columbine High School. It's part of a special collaboration with Guns and America, a reporting project that explores the relationship between we in the U.S. and our firearms. Now, Lee, when it comes to Columbine, how do actual high school students feel about it?
Yeah, we had some of our reporters ask the high school kids they interviewed in their communities about Columbine, and a lot of them said something like this.
Have you ever heard of Columbine High School?
No, I haven't.
Have you heard of Columbine?
Yes, I have.
What do you know about it?
Students. Was it students that basically shot up the school? And they, I mean, I'm not sure of the full extent to it, but that's all I pretty much heard.
Are you familiar with Columbine or what happened there at that school 20 years ago?
I might have heard of something, but I could be confusing it with something else, so I'm not 100% sure.
The fact of the matter is, Columbine happened before these kids were born. Even the students who had heard of it really only knew about it through movies.
When I watch everything about Columbine, it's all through like a documentary footage or like a news crew filming it and all. But like with Parkland, it was like we were seeing Snapchat videos of kids like in the classroom, like the dudes right outside the classroom shooting, and it's like they're filming it under the desks like with their Snapchat and all. That was like eye-opening. It was like that's us.
So let's back up to Columbine itself, back before Snapchat, before smartphones, before all of our lives were so very deeply digital. How did activists back then get people to really understand what it was like to live through a mass shooting?
So back to the year 2000. It's election night in Denver.
There's one more hero that I know you've all been waiting to hear from tonight.
This is a victory party for the passing of a ballot measure called Amendment 22, which closed something called the gun show loophole by requiring background checks for firearm purchases at gun shows.
It is an honor and a pleasure to introduce Tom Mauser.
You had a big smile on your face when you got up to the podium. What was that like for you?
Oh, it was heavenly. It really was heavenly.
What a sweet night.
Yeah! I know some people would say, oh, gee, isn't it bittersweet? You know, you're still just a little more over than a year since the tragedy. But no, that was just one of the great moments.
That night at the podium, Tom Mauser reaches down and holds up a pair of large white sneakers.
In Daniel's shoes.
In Daniel's shoes, he says, his son's shoes.
I could say, you know, we did this in Daniel's name. The people of Colorado did it, and he provided the inspiration for it.
Tom's son Daniel was one of the 12 students killed at Columbine High School 20 years ago. When I interviewed Tom recently at his church, he was wearing another pair of his son's shoes, Vans, the kind of skater shoes that were popular back then. In Tom's retelling of the day Daniel was murdered, he talks of a steady progression, from seeing something about a shooting on the news, to waiting around at a local elementary school for more information, to being asked what Daniel was wearing that day, and then for his dental records. Still, no final word.
So we went to bed that night not knowing if Daniel was dead or alive. We just had some faint hope that maybe he was in some room someplace hiding. And then it wasn't until noon the next day that the sheriff's office called, came to our house, and gave us the bad news that he was one of the victims.
This, of course, is what has motivated Tom to push for gun control. But he also points to one very specific moment.
Just 2 weeks before his death, Daniel asked me a question at the dinner table. Dad, did you know there are loopholes in the Brady Bill? That's the national law that requires background checks when you purchase a gun. And I just kind of didn't pay much attention. I said, no, I didn't know there were loopholes, Daniel. 2 weeks later, he was killed with a gun that was purchased through a loophole in the Brady Bill. So for me, that was, oh my God, I have to react to that. I have to respond to that.
Tom responded by getting involved almost immediately. And from there, it was one thing after another, starting with the NRA's annual convention, which was scheduled to take place in Denver less than 2 weeks after the shooting at Columbine. The event was scaled back, but not canceled. On the day of the event, news organizations reported that thousands of people gathered around the convention site in protest. Tom wasn't planning to speak, but he did.
A Tech 9 semi-automatic
30-bullet weapon like that that killed my son is not used to kill deer. It has no useful purpose.
Inside, at the convention, NRA President Charlton Heston talked about how the tragedy had been politicized and criticized media coverage. He also said that the right to bear arms is not a right without rational restrictions. Wayne LaPierre, the executive vice president of the NRA, talked about gun-free zones.
We believe in absolutely gun-free, zero-tolerance, totally safe schools. That means no guns in America's schools, period, with the rare exception of law enforcement officers or trained security personnel.
LaPierre has since changed his tune. In the aftermath of the Sandy Hook shooting, he called for armed police officers in every single American school. But back then, after the NRA protest, Mauser's push for gun control continued. He traveled to Washington, he lobbied state legislators, and for those who were opposed to what he was saying,
there was really a sense of, you know, we really feel for you and your pain. Can't imagine what you're going through. However, I also heard through other channels that the feeling of some of those legislators was that I really shouldn't be there. I think it made them feel uncomfortable.
After striking out in the legislature, Tom and others pushed for the ballot measure instead, Amendment 22, which required background checks on sales at gun shows. Part of his push was fundraising.
Part of it was speaking at Rotary Club meetings, you know, kind of looking at those sort of moderate audiences. Part of it was meeting with district attorneys, with the Police Chiefs Association, with some sheriffs, talking about the issue. How do we work together to close the gun show loophole?
During this time after the shooting, life was kind of crazy. Tom was working a full-time job, lobbying on the side, grieving, going to Columbine-related events, and he and his wife adopted a baby girl from China.
So much change in a year for your family. Wow.
Yeah, that first year, I look back on, I think of what all we went through. I don't know how we did it.
Tom said that the activism part of his life did help him take his mind off things.
You know, you can't escape that grief. But yeah, you can put it aside a little bit to a certain extent.
What a sweet night.
Yeah! And in the end, Tom helped close the gun show loophole. Amendment 22 passed with 70% of the vote. But after that, the movement kind of dissolved. Tom has stayed active, of course, but back then, he says that a lot of people felt as though the goal had been achieved. People moved on.
Today, clearly, it's much different. Because of social media, it's just so different. In 1999, when students reacted, it was just out of shock and fear and just a general, oh my God. And here it is 20 years later, and they're saying, but wait a minute, this is still happening. This is part of us now, too.
Together, because if all our government and president can do is send thoughts and prayers, then it's time for victims to be the change that we need to see.
And when you see David Hogg or Emma Gonzalez on TV and you watch how much momentum the movement has now, like, what do you think about that?
Oh, it's exciting. It is so exciting to see them get engaged in this issue. We didn't really have that back in 1999. But their voices are so strong, and they reacted so quickly. It's so encouraging for me to see that happen.
Tom says that the conversation now is more sophisticated. Banning bump stocks, for example, and passing extreme risk laws, also known as red flag laws. These are measures that allow firearms to be temporarily taken away from someone in crisis. Earlier this month, after passionate debate and disagreement, the Colorado legislature voted to pass one of these laws.
I think we're seeing both more support and yet a stronger resistance than we had back in 1999.
There's one issue Tom might be willing to compromise on, and it brings us back to the beginning of this hour, to Evan Todd.
Well, I will say one thing. I do not support arming teachers in our schools. But I have to say, when it comes to the very rural areas where they are a half an hour from a police station, I understand their desire to protect their kids by having firearms in that school. And I think they need to be well trained. But I can understand their position that in those very rural areas, they want to protect themselves.
Tom Mauser feels as though he's passing the torch on to a group of highly motivated, very savvy young people, most of whom hadn't even been born yet when Columbine happened.
Yeah, and some of them already have built some pretty high profiles, like Emma Gonzalez and David Hogg, two of the students from Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida. I mean, I'm looking online. David Hogg's got almost 1 million followers. Emma Gonzalez is more than 1.6 million, and that's just on Twitter.
Right, right. But it's important to remember that there are also so many other young people doing this work in their own communities across the country. Tay Anderson is one of them. He's 20 years old and lives in Denver.
I'm an educator at North High School.
Tay's running for Denver School Board, and he advocates for gun violence reduction from two perspectives, wanting to keep kids safe in schools and also wanting to keep people in communities safe.
In 2016, on my birthday, July 5th, Philando Castillo was murdered. And I got tired of losing unarmed African-American males because that could have been me. Trayvon Martin could have been me.
The Parkland school shooting compounded that feeling. Tay became president of a youth-led organization called Never Again Colorado. He gave a speech at the March for Our Lives event in Denver last year.
So he's pretty active in this cause, but does Tay have a personal connection to gun violence?
Yeah, he does, especially very recently.
My former assistant principal at the school I worked at earlier this year was killed to gun violence.
Investigators in Aurora believe the men had argued over a parking spot on the block. When they met to resolve the issue, one man pulled a gun. The
victim. And he had his one day where the press was all about it and it was buzzing everywhere.
TJ Cunningham had played in the NFL.
When he died, he was a popular assistant principal in the Aurora Public Schools.
CBS 4. Not long after, the news moved on.
When you say Parkland, or when you say Santa Fe High School or Columbine High School, those are names that you'll always remember. When people of color die, it's normal. But when a mass shooting happens, then it's our thoughts, our prayers. We have to send help. We have to change laws. We don't have laws being changed for us every single day. And we don't have to talk about Chicago to talk about people of color when it comes to gun violence.
Lee, let's take a step back. More broadly, what do we know about how young people are affected by gun violence?
Yeah, so according to a new study that was published in the American Journal of Medicine, nearly 39,000 kids in the U.S. were fatally shot between 1999 and 2017. The authors of that report noted a steep rise in deaths among Black children starting in 2013.
It happens everywhere, and we have to pay attention to it everywhere because it's not just saying Chicago and white suburban areas. It's the United States of America that has a gun issue.
That was activist and Denver School Board candidate Tay Anderson speaking to KUNC's Lee Patterson. Lee, let's zoom out a little bit further before we have to let you go. Talk about how gun violence has changed in the 20 years since Columbine. I mean, writ large, has America got more violent or less violent or stayed the same?
Well, generally more violent. The number of gun deaths has been rising pretty steadily in the U.S. since Columbine. In 2017, nearly 40,000 people died from gunshot wounds, and 60% of those deaths were suicides.
We spent the hour looking at what has changed since Columbine. Before we let you go, I'd be interested in knowing your assessment of what has not changed since then. What are some of the biggest things that remain the same 20 years on?
Well, school shootings still happen. Gun violence still happens. Case in point, this whole incident with Sol Pais that unfolded in Colorado this week. I think people coming from many, many, many different viewpoints are frustrated. They're frustrated that this still happens. They're frustrated that the solutions that they support haven't fully been put in place.
And we should be clear, by the way, the story of Sol Pais is still very much open. There are still a lot of gaps in terms of who she is, what motivated her, what exactly the narrative was behind that, right?
Yes, yes, of course. This is a developing story. The FBI is still investigating. And we are really, you know, reporting what we're hearing and what we're understanding as it comes out.
A lot of folks who are listening, I think, are kind of resigned to the fact that this is a threat anywhere in the country at any time, especially those of us who were young adults when Columbine happened. I think you were in your mid-teens when it happened. I was just new to the University of Miami. And since then, the anniversary is also linked to what likely led to 60% of Colorado schools being closed, this incident with Sol País, because of a credible gun threat. Before I let you go, what's your sense based on your reporting of what people can do, of what is being done to change the way we deal with violence in schools?
Well, what's important to know is that people with many, many different viewpoints are getting involved. We've heard from some of them in this hour. People are voicing their concerns for the need for things like mental health services, programs like Safe to Tell. School districts all over the country are deciding what kinds of physical security measures that they're going to put in place, whether that means hiring armed security personnel or in some cases even allowing concealed carry. And, you know, here in Colorado, again, going back to what happened this week, some communities are making decisions to keep kids at home. And I would just say that some of the reporting I've done should leave people with some hope, because in spite of all of the attention on school shootings and in spite of how truly terrifying they are, evidence shows that school is one of the safest places that your child can be.
That's KUNC's Lee Patterson, a reporter with Guns and America. Lee, we appreciate all your reporting. Thanks very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Thanks also to Amanda Andrews at KUNC and to the whole Guns and America team. You could find more of their work online at gunsandamerica.org. This conversation was produced by Paige Osborne, edited by A.C. Valdez and Lisa Dunn. To learn more about Paige and the rest of the 1A team, go to the 1A.org/staff. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Joshua Johnson. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you tomorrow for the Friday News Roundup. This is 1A.